I'm wondering if you could graph for us and tell the story, oh, cosmic storyteller, of your own meditative development. When you first started to meditate,
sure.
What techniques you used.
Sure. Well, like a lot of children of the 60s, I tried so many different types of growth techniques and meditative practices and so on that it's almost impossible to say which are most responsible for the wreck you see in front of you now. And I don't want to end up, overly laying the blame of too much of this on particular traditions. But I can sort of give a few highlights, so to speak, things that I think were most important in my own process. One was kind of an ongoing psychotherapy that I would characterize on general is very close to Gestalt. I did Fritz Perls' variety. I did a lot of actual Gestalt of that variety. My own first mentor in this field was a gentleman named Bob Jung, and he had actually studied with Franz Alexander, who had studied with Freud. And Franz Alexander was the guy that introduced psychosomatic medicine in this country. He's actually quite well known. And one of his students was Fritz Perls. So I think there's kind of a certain lineage there that I got. But it's a very powerful technique of basically assuming responsibility for your own states. And I always really appreciated Fritz Perls for that, although there were literally dozens of other types of therapy. I did a lot of Jungian therapy. I did a lot of just looking at psychoanalytic material because it's been so influential, and did a little bit of psychoanalysis myself. At the time I was doing all of that, though, I started doing particularly Zen meditation. And I started with a type of just sitting meditation, which is technically called Shikantaza, which is most common with a branch of Zen called Soto. But it's really a kind of a basic meditative practice of just witnessing, just watching what arises moment to moment. And that's kind of an essential form of meditation found the world over. And I've done that really constantly since my early 20s. My first sort of breakthrough to Sesshin came with a wonderful gentleman named Katagiri Roshi. Katagiri was out of Zen Center in San Francisco, where he was a main successor of Suzuki Roshi, who was sort of a hero for everybody. Zen mind, beginner's mind, is still one of the most brilliant statements of sort of ever-present non-dual awareness that you will ever find. And Katagiri was an embodiment of that, a wonderful human being. And I did this, I was in Nebraska at the time, washing dishes, and I was a waiter at the Red Rooster restaurant, finest fried chicken in five-state area. And I did that for about a decade while I was writing these books and doing meditation, psychotherapy, and anything else I could think of. That was an important sort of awakening for me because it really helped orient to the fact that there is this ever-present state that can be realized in something called Satori or something similar to it. I began a curious correspondence course with about four or five Zen masters at that time, in addition to whatever practice I could find. This was in the early 70s, and there just wasn't a whole lot of meditation going on. Certainly very hard to find centers of meditation. So there were maybe a dozen good Zen masters in this country. And I sort of struck up, correspondence courses with them, including Meizumi Roshi out of Los Angeles and Edo Roshi out of New York, who assigned me the koan Mu by mail. I'm sure that must be some sort of footnote in some Zen annal somewhere. Suzaki Roshi also, and continued to
And what did you do with that koan? Where did you get with it?
Oh, I worked on it for about 2.5 years.
And what was the resolution?
Yeah, it was very, and I think not with him, but it came out in a subsequent practice, and it was pretty clear that it was the culmination of that practice. And I was doing this, again, largely on my own, although we had started a small kind of sangha or group of practitioners in the Lincoln area in Nebraska, and writing books, basically, writing very, very intensely, continuing with psychotherapy as well. And I did a lot of sensory awareness at that time with Charlotte Salvers, who actually sort of invented sensory awareness. And she was a good friend of Jerry Gilbert, who was one of the local group that sort of gathered around Bob Jung, this sort of mentor. And there were probably, five of us that were interested in. And Katagiri would come by, like the old preachers used to come by in a five-state area and marry people every 3 months or something. So he would come by and drop off and do a session, sit with us out at a little farm that Jerry and her husband, Lou Gilbert, owned. And so that was actually, it was great. I love that period. And for me, it was really just simply deepening a capacity for meditative awareness combined with sensory awareness too. So it was sort of ascending and descending, it seems to me, along with psychotherapy, which is sort of trying to patch up, whatever Ken Wilber is kind of running around while the rest of you is sort of trying to get rid of the little Dickens and Fence and Mouse. So part of the internal contradictions of doing all those things is almost certainly why I was interested in integrative endeavors, because I knew they were all right. They were all correct. Every single one of these things had something important to say, and they all disagreed with each other. So pretty much. So I had to sort of work to fashion some sort of coherent approach that would honor all of these things and all of the truths that they were embodying. Didn't have a lot of experience with psychedelics, so I don't have much to say about that, except I just really didn't have a lot of experience with it. So that's not part of the deranged state that I'm in now. So I can't claim that, although most of my friends were experimenting one way or another with that. I did a fair amount of work with Vedanta. I did a fair amount of work with Taoist studies. I did a lot of Tai Chi Chuan. I've been doing Hatha Yoga and did Hatha Yoga intensely for about 15 years. I became increasingly interested in Tibetan Buddhism just because Zen, I think Needleman once said that Zen was essential Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism was complete Buddhism. That's sort of what it is. I mean, Zen just goes right to the heart, Satori. This is it, Satori. You don't have Satori, you don't have Buddhism. But Tibetan, Vajrayana, is like the whole shebang. I mean, it's got every single aspect, vehicle, gross, subtle, causal, all sorts of practices. So I increasingly got into that because I mostly really wanted to just see what was there. And it was such an exquisite and profound system. And did that for about the next 15 years, in addition to sort of this basic meditative practice. I ended up having probably about a half a dozen teachers in Zen and about a half dozen teachers I would consider important in Vajrayana. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was very important. Kalu Rinpoche was important. My root Dzogchen teachers, Chaga Tolku, in the lineage of the Nyingma. And, of course, the present head of the Nyingma today is Penor Rinpoche. I still, strangely, don't necessarily consider myself a Buddhist, because even though I've talked about my main teachers here, I did an enormous amount of study and practice of contemplative Christianity, various types of Sufism, certainly of the Western tradition. And the particular types of meditation that I've been drawn to are similar in the various traditions. I mean, they really have a great deal of similarity to them. So I've never really felt that I somehow specifically was Buddhist and not something else. I do think that as a contemplative path, Buddhist is just about as profound as you can get. But there are many, many other profound traditions that I've been very happy studying with.
So when was your first Satori experience and what was it like?
You know, you get in trouble when you talk about that let me briefly say why, and then I'll go ahead and get in trouble.
Well, I knew as soon as I said the question. I was creating trouble, but...
People aren't... They're not trying to avoid the question when they say it really doesn't have meaning. But since I know what you mean by it, I'm going to answer it. But let me first say why it's so awkward. The whole... We've been using the term Satori, and we'll just keep using it. The whole realization or Satori experience is that the interesting nature about it is that it's a profound experience and nobody is experiencing it. There simply is no separate self in this whole thing. So you can use different words for that, but they're all inexpressible, like we were talking about earlier. No real word captures it because every word is going to be dualistic, and that's just not it. So I'll try nonetheless. I mean, so the idea is there's this vast awareness. Everything is arising moment to moment, but there's no you. You are not on this side of your face looking at stuff out there. There simply is everything arising moment to moment. And if you are anything, you are all of that. Now, you're also aware of where Ken Wilber is, and you're aware of where the table is, and so on. But it's not that Ken Wilber is having a realization of all of that. It's that Ken Wilber is part of what is arising. So it's not that Ken is realizing this. That just doesn't happen. Ken Wilber never has that realization. There's simply that realization, and Ken Wilber arises, the clouds arise, this body arises, the table arises. So to say, I, Ken Wilber, had this experience, it's weird. It never kind of feels right. But if you say, no, I never had the experience, and people say, well, okay, aren't you adult? And then it doesn't kind of work anyway. So with all that hemming and hawing, I had my first really profound experience. Kensho means a small Satori. It's sort of a breakthrough. And I had those types of experiences. I think a lot of people have them into childhood, which I certainly think happens because you have the three great states of waking, dream, and deep sleep available, even in early childhood. And I have a whole series of kind of experiences of those. But the first sort of formal thing that we would call Kensho did happen with Katagiri Roshi at one of the retreats in Nebraska in my early 20s. And it was very important. And it happened, I was in the state of witnessing. I had been for maybe 3 days, and very, very intense. So it was, in a sense, body-mind was dropped, and I had this clear witnessing awareness. And Category knew this, and he knew two things. He knew that's a fairly high state, but it's still not non-dual. And so very deliberately and clearly at one point he said, the witness is the last stand of the ego. This is during a very intense meditative, and something snapped at that point. And that was a very real non-dual Kensho state, not a permanent realization, that I was probably in as a state for a couple of hours. But the memory, the realization of it stays with you forever. That's what's so kind of interesting about it. And the analogy for that, and I'll move on to some of the other examples, but the analogy, because some people have a hard time understanding that, but there's a very good analogy that one of the great Vedanta philosophers used. And that's, if you are in a darkened room and in the corner there is a snake, and you're sort of brought up in this darkened room with that snake over there, and you live in terror of that snake most of your life. And then one time somebody comes in and flicks a light on, and it actually lights up the room, and you look in the corner, and it's actually a coiled rope. It's not a snake. It's just a stupid rope. And then the light goes off again. Well, now you can't see the rope anymore, so it's just a temporary state. But you're never going to be afraid. I mean, that memory, so to speak, that living realization stays with you. That's what a Kensho is like. A first experience is seeing that the things that scare the daylights out of you, they just really can't fundamentally scare you again. You just can't quite be tricked again because you've seen the dream of life. You've seen through the illusion that there's a snake out there that's going to hurt you. And that realization, that awakening to the emptiness, the transparency of everything that's arising moment to moment, is a first Kensho. And so that was very important because even though it faded, I would never be afraid of the snake again. So those types of experiences are common as you continue to meditate. And you increase your capacity for witnessing. And then on occasions, you increase your capacity for this non-dual, ever-present awareness. It started to extend into the dream state. So lucid dreaming sort of occurred. Again, I was doing many practices at this time. And probably the most profound experience, at least for me, was when I was doing sex ecology spirituality. And I'm sure a large part of the book, in a sense, came out of and had something to do with this. But for about an 11-day period, I was in just sort of constant 24-hour-a-day awareness, either witnessing or non-dual. And so what would happen is my body would go to sleep. I would see that. The dream state would emerge. I would be aware of that. The deep, formless sleep state would emerge. And there was a tacit awareness of that. Ken Wilber isn't aware of it. Ken Wilber disappears someplace in between waking and dreaming. But there's this ever-present, tacit noticing or awareness that is what you are. It's this fundamental reality. And so that's a shifting again of identity to this pure I amness, of this pure self, in which these various states arise. And one of the ways, it's not the only way, it's not necessary, but one of the ways to do that is when you actually do sort of remain conscious 24 hours, because you actually see all these states come and go, and you realize there's something in you that does not come and go. There's something in you that is fundamentally ever present, in which nothing happens. It's that absolute formless ground out of which all of this happens. That was a very interesting 11 days, a bit mildly. And then there's been a kind of deepening since that. And also losses of it. I mean, sometimes it blinks strong and sometimes it doesn't. But the actual awareness is like the snake and the rope. It's something that never, ever leaves you in that sense.
It's interesting that you said that your own realization, correct me if I'm wrong here, but what I heard you say is that it's not a permanent 24-hour, 7-day-a-week full-on blast-o-rama as much as...
It was during that 11-day period.
Right, but right. I mean, you know, Mondays and Thursdays, your right. language function right. or whatever. And yet, I can think of one teacher in particular, but other people who have claimed a type of absolute enlightenment, as if they've reached the end game. I always question that. So what do you think about that?
It's very hard to interpret that. And because a whole lot of it has to do with what we talked about in terms of the snake and the rope. And certain of these kinds of experiences carry an indelible, ever-present understanding. And that stays with you. So you have to be that's permanent, and that's just there it is. And so you have to kind of be careful, particularly these very profound one taste or non-dual or sahaj experiences always carry that. They're very, very profound. And what they're carrying is, you know, there is no snake. That's a little bit different then if somebody is actually in that 24-hour-a-day current of constant consciousness, and to be honest, the only way we could really tell that right now is to hook them up to an EEG machine and see what their brain is doing.
Have you ever met anybody who you think is in a 24/7 constant non-dual current?
No.
Thank you.
There are people that are closer and farther away. There are people that have more access to it. There are people that have had profound non-dual Satori experiences. There are people that have had plateau non-dual experiences. There are people whose non-dual experiences are profound and are plateau experiences that have permeated a good deal of their personality so that a lot of their developmental lines are rising up to that non-dual realization. And there are others who have had profound non-dual realizations and they haven't shown very much development at all. And sometimes they're actually kind of pigheaded in certain ways. And they don't show very good development in some of the developmental lines. But they still have had this profound one-taste realization. It's a very delicate issue because once you have that realization, it's impossible to get a crowbar into your own awareness and pry out the bullshit. Because when you're one with everything, there's no space to get the crowbar in. And so you have to be very careful at that point because you can't have a discussion very well with some of these folks, many of whom are my good friends, because it's very hard to stand outside of yourself when there's no place outside of yourself. So part of what we're trying to do now is get a sangha of these individuals who've had some of these kinds of realizations and just butt them up against each other. Because things start to crack at that point. Because they can't all be the only enlightened person on the planet. You know, I mean, you just lock six of them in one room for a couple hours and just let them go. My sense is that in my own case, and I'm not claiming a full enlightenment, I think that 11-day period was as full an experience as one can have. But I think that that has to continue unbroken, is my own opinion. And it did not in my case, although I get into that in a sense, meaning the actual physiology of it. So there are times when I will remain aware 24 hours a day during waking, dream, and deep sleep, and then times when I won't. But I never forget that state. I mean, that state is ever present with me, but that actual current is not always ever present. And I think some of these people confuse those two. I think some of them have a great deal of this current going, but I don't think it's permanent, as far as I can tell, 24 hours a day, unendingly.